point which you're going to ask about here in a minute, but we're not there in section 12 of the Swanson. We're gonna get there.
I'm just trying to get this clear in my mind. I have a feeling that you'll either, as a private landowner, you will either volunteer or involuntarily they'll take you anyway.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swanson, if you will defer that question for a moment while we'll be right there four square. If I may, I'll continue with section 13. This is an addition to the definition of to the definition section, and in particular, it's an alphabet addition to the definition of waste. And in under paragraph 170, which is the definition section of Title 31, 11 is the definition of waste. Waste means, in addition to its ordinary meaning, physical waste, and includes, and it takes the alphabet all the way down through I, each I, and we are adding to that alphabet a J, which says that the drilling of wells unnecessary to carry out the purpose of or intent of this chapter, which is the purpose and intent of the chapter, is to maximize the recovery of oil and or gas, hydrocarbons, from a reservoir. It says that that the drilling of unnecessary wells to carry out that purpose is waste.
Now, does that, may I, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Swanson.
Does that mean that in Prudhoe Bay that you have to do, the commissioner could come in and say you've got a well here, the next well that you can drill has got to be no less than 5 miles from there, that he couldn't drill one at 2 miles and 3 miles, but the limitation? Is that what you're saying?
If he feels that in the interest of maximizing the recovery of oil from that reservoir, that that is right, that he is right and he's on firm ground with that, that is exactly what it is saying. Carried to a very great extreme. Chairman, we go now to section 14, which we is in the definition section. We've already touched on it. As you recall, this is the definition of a landowner, meaning the owner of the subsurface estate. Section 15, this is the one exception to everything dealing with Title 31. This deals with Title 38. This again requires that our lease forms from now on out shall include the language that is in quotation, starting the landowner's royalty share. This again, if our lease forms had this in it, or went, would have kept us out of the courthouse. Come to section 16, and this is, Mr. Chairman, and particularly to you, Representative Swanson, is the very substantive change that this bill is proposing. This repeals 3105-110-D. And that, and in the repealing of that section, it makes us one state out of 50 that has the power to mandate unitization of oil and gas leases within the state of Alaska. The existing statute says that we can only mandate unitization under the condition that 62.5% of the working interest owners agree to be unitized, and 62.5% of the royalty interest owners agree to be unitized. We cannot force unitization if we don't get that agreement. Now, why do we want to force unitization, be in a position to force unitization, Mr. Chairman? Very simply, that probably the unitized operation of an oil field is permissive to the best and is almost mandatory to good reservoir management to maximize the ultimate recovery of hydrocarbon. In a unit, all leases, a unit in effect acts as one lease. All leases within the unit are considered as being in effect one lease, and we work with them. We get away from the possibility of competitive drainage by owners of contiguous parcels. Unitization, in my mind, is a very important and is an absolute necessity to ensure good reservoir management. So that is why this bill proposes to be that.
Just by way of history, and maybe, well, he is gone, I guess, I'd sure be interested to see, was that in the original yeah, that was 1955. That's not been changed. Okay. There's, I believe, line 23 of section 8 and also section 11 that we got to whack on.
Line 23 of section.
That was the part that's held there.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Skip right. Over.
Right, section 11. Now, okay, this is deals in existing statute. Now, we've already mentioned that we can only force unitization if 62.5% of everybody agrees to it. This little paren O in section 11, mm-hmm. why deals with the enlargement of a unit, which we can only expand the unit if the people affected within that area agree, and so this completely changes that to where we can mandate the expansion.
Okay, just chops out that language. Yeah, all right. Mr. Green,
well, why did the percentage 62.5? What significance does that have?
I, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, I don't know the answer to that. I guess we'd have to ask Bill Holdsworth.
You mentioned the other states; they have percentage requirements. Agreement for before the rest are mandated in.
Yes, they do, Representative Greeny. Keep in mind that Title 31, to a high degree, was lifted primarily from statutes, the Oil and Gas Conservation Statute of New Mexico, State of New Mexico, and somewhat a little bit of some of the Oklahoma statutes. Keep in mind that we in Alaska are very unique. As Representative Byrne has said many times on the floor, there's in the South 48 states, why most of the lands are in private ownership, and we have to be a public land state, and...
Socialist, in other words. Let's face it.
I think that's another reason why we need to go with this.
Well, I don't mind being unique or even number one.
I don't either.
Like, I think a lot of areas we ought to be number one. But I'm just trying to understand why the rationale is for setting any percentage there.
I presume, and I leave it to you attorneys, I presume it had to be sort of going back to the majority rule type of a deal, and you can't force anybody that is owner of private lands to do something without due process of law. That's the only rationale I can think of. Again, why someone from the department is much more knowledgeable on this than I. I can't answer your question, I guess, is where I'm coming from. Now, Mr. Chairman, I do have, speaking alone, and I have some proposed amendments to this bill. I know the time is late. I would like to pass these out, if I may. The bill that you have before you has been a moving target, and we're supposed to send them on down around.
Okay.
Let it keep going. And every time we read them, we get a new idea. So I don't know whether you would have time to look at these amendments. I passed the one that was my favorite sheet. Thanks. Anybody need another copy?
I think Doral got one.
No.
Maybe we need one more.
These are...
Got one more there.
Yeah, got one more here. The... okay. Tell me when to shut up here, Mr. Chairman, but I'll quickly go through here. There are actually five proposed amendments all on this one sheet. The first one is page 1, line 20. It deletes from the bill dip meter surveys. Now, very simply, existing statute accepts, says that the state may not require operators to furnish dip meter surveys. This is a survey that tells you the attitude of the subsurface formations in, with respect to the wellbore. It's very, to my mind, it's a very important piece of information that we in the state of Alaska should have and every right to have. Enters into many decisions which I will not bore you with now. So it deletes that exception, and we will now be able to require dip meter surveys. This amendment is out of, this amendment sheet is out of order. Please drop down to now, so we stay in context, to the very bottom where it says page 1, line 24. And this is going to take more time than what we have, but I'll basically show what it does. The current statute says that information marked confidential shall be kept confidential for 24 months. This amendment changes that to 48 months. I have very good reasons, but I won't take the time. Now please jump back up here to where it says page 1 between lines 26 and 27. It would add that particular language that notwithstanding, either if you accept the 48 fine, if you leave it at 24, notwithstanding that term, why information that is a statute confidential shall be kept confidential for so long as needed until unleased lands that are affected by this information are leased. Mr. Chairman, there are some operators in the state of Alaska now that have coming right up on their heels the end of the 24 months period of confidentiality. They have spent tens of millions of dollars drilling into a land sale, which they unfortunately thought would have been before us. And they stand to have to now share all of that information that has been extremely costly to them with every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the industry.
When is that date coming up?
I think the first well affected was about the end of May. I don't know.
We've already had some that have been affected.
Last we've already had
one was released.
One's already been released.
Scattered out.
We're right into two where the whole flock of them are going to happen.
Prudhoe Bay.
They were
drilled on the rim.
Into the assumed by now joint state federal land sale.
Mm-hmm. Here for sea sale.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. Very quickly. Down to. I told you I didn't want to address myself to page 3, line 23. Obviously, after we went through and through, we didn't want to change shall to may after all. So I want to change the may on line 23 to page 3. I want to change it back to shall.
All right.
On page 8, line 20, line 4, we dealt there with the expansion of a unit, but I very carelessly overlooked, had no mechanism for the contraction of a unit. And so on line 4 there, after the word otherwise amended, or the unit area contracted, this now gives us a mechanism for not only expanding the unit, but for contracting the unit, which is most desirable from a state standpoint in many respects. I believe that that's the end of the proposed amendments.
Okay, what I'd like to do, Chad, is of course, it's 10 o'clock and we've got capital move business this afternoon. I'd like to come back to this at 8:30 tomorrow morning if it's possible. That needs your approval, because we will be taking, I believe, House Bill 854, which is another matter relating to oil and gas.
Hopefully you'll have, Mr. Chair, hopefully you'll have 8:30 there tomorrow morning.
Sure will.
Okay, all right.
And so we'll continue these hearings until 8:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We would, is Commissioner Gallagher here? I guess he's in front. All right. We will resume our hearings on the capital move financing. Commissioner Gallagher was supposed to be here, but I guess he didn't show. The second set of witnesses scheduled would be from White Welding Company, Mr. Ted Swick. Swick, are you ready to?
Your pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so why don't we let you go ahead? Perhaps you could both take a seat if you'd like at the end of the table. And.
We had understood that Commissioner Gallagher was going to be here. Kind of wish you were.
Well, I guess they.
Why don't you give him a call?
There's some problem, I suppose. Let me get you a hold on. apparently notified and they haven't showed up, so I guess we're just gonna pop on them. What else to do?
All right, sir.
Mr. Swett?
I might preface my remarks that we wanted to make in regard to the capital move and the financing.
Oh, okay. Maybe we do have a commission. The, the order was to have been on the Commissioner Gallagher first, and since Commissioner Gallagher wasn't here, we, maybe we'll go back to the original order, Mr. Swett.
We can switch.
Have you jump it up and down like that, but I think everybody would prefer to have the other order, yourself included.
Can we stay here? Do you want us?
Maybe Commissioner Gallagher can take a seat down there, because that's where the best soundtrack.
That runs the electrodes in it?
That's gonna become the electric chair.
Commissioner Gallagher, and as I understand it, Commissioner, you will address the question of state bonding capacity and how it might be affected by the proposed bond issues arising from the capital move.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm spelling Gallagher, then the Commissioner of Revenue is spelled. There are two different reports done on this whole question of bonding capacity. Both start with the same premise and come to widely different conclusions. Mike Weld said that the bonding capacity was based on the ability to market. I see something even more basic than that. One of the assumptions I think the state should go in going into the capital move should make the assumption that we don't want to worsen our financial condition in order to move the capital. And that goes somewhat along to I think quite well in doing their study missed one of the basic points. So in order to have the ability to market bonds, which they said the ability of bond capacity was based on, there's even something more basic than that, and that's the ability to pay. And once you have an ability to pay, then you might have an ability to market something later. Currently, the state's debt service is somewhere running around 4% of the state's budget, 4 to 5.5, right in that range. White Weld claimed that we could go up to 16%. I think it would be very dangerous. Currently,
excuse me, Commissioner, you're talking about 16% of general fund appropriations within a given year?
Yes. Currently, oil makes up 60% of our budget, 65% of our budget. And, you know, they've based this assumption on that things are gonna go on rosy in the future, that oil prices will continue to be good, the world market conditions will stay up. But as we've seen the last year, we've seen that the oil prices in terms of real dollars has actually gone down again. The OPEC countries are discounting heavily in the market to a surplus of crude. I'm not crying doomsday or anything like that, but the price of energy in the last 2 years, last year in terms of real dollars has actually gone down. And so since so much of our budget is really based on one line and one thin line, 48 inches long, our fortune rise and fall with that line. Now if they base their 16% on total revenues, you take the line out of that question or depreciate the price of oil substantially, and that 16% might come up as high as 40% and 50%. And I wouldn't recommend at all to the legislature of running that liberal with the amount of debt service in the state's budget. One of the things that's very important about debt capacity is the ability to go back to the market. Let's say the price of oil did go down in the future. Then look at the numbers and look at the ability to market in the future. I think if we had a debt service number like that and the price of oil went down, and there's no way we can, you know, physically raise that by ourselves, the state of Alaska. It isn't like we don't have some public utilities commission out there who will go out and raise the rate for us just to help us pay the bonds. It isn't that one of those sort of situations. We're just kind of working at the whim of some foreign government and working at the whim of supply and demand in the world market, and we're riding a very thin edge. One of the things the White Well report says that nothing intrigues an investor more than lending to a government which is improving its credit position and so have its investment grow in relative value. Well, currently, the state debt service is 5% of the total general fund revenues. They think it can go up to 18%. That's certainly not a situation in improving state credit. That's a situation with the decline in state credit. There's nothing, the corollary to that, there's nothing like a deteriorating credit that investors don't want to invest in. On the other hand, we had another report done by a different firm, Dean Litter, that looked at what sort of debt service would be like if we sold the capital move and looked at other state programs. And it's, if you go on the premise that you don't want to deteriorate your present debt service position, namely 5.5% of general fund operating revenues, and let's face facts, that if you take oil out of the budget, that's still a very substantial number. That is maybe 12% of the budget. Let's look, for a minute, go over how many states are above us in terms of debt service. There are two or three states that are above us in terms of debt services percentage of the budget. New York, Connecticut, and Hawaii. All three credits are equal to our rating or lower. We're rated the same as Hawaii, but we trade 50 basis points better. Because, namely, the oil is in the budget, we do have a better debt service as a percentage of the overall budget, that sort of relationship, and we can see some improving things in the future that are promises to pay, but you can't depend on those totally. So it is trading at some slight premium to these other credits, but it's not great. Now, if you're going to make the assumption that we're not going to deteriorate our credit, namely keep it at the 5.5%, the Dean Witter report said you can spend an additional $25 to $30 million a year over and above these, other than the capital move bonds. If you want to go up to the New York and the Connecticut ratio of 8%, you can go up to spend as high as, I think it was 50 or 60 million dollars a year in additional bonds. That is, if you want to let your credit decline to the tune of Connecticut and New York, which are kind of the lesser credits in the market, you can do that.
Excuse me, Commissioner Gallagher, if I can interrupt you. How many states are authorized to go into debt for any capital improvement? I know several are not. Do you know how many are?
Well,
I think it's only about 5 or 6, Mr. Chairman. One South Dakota, and it's a few, mostly Midwestern states.
Okay. In addition to New York and Connecticut and Hawaii.
Well, I think there is about 44 do sell debt. There's about 6 that don't.
Oh, 6 that don't, okay. Colorado does it, for us.
Right.
Okay.
South Dakota, Washington, Oregon, California, all sell. Idaho has had its first issue in 10 years recently.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Freeman.
Well, Mr. Gallagher, would you straighten me out here on the, I'd like to know what, at the present, what percent of the state's budget, general fund budget is for debt service? I started out, I thought you said 4, and then I hear 5, and then 5 and a half.
I think it's 4.3, 4.4, somewhere in there, as you recall.
Well then, how did I get mixed up on the 5 and the 5 and a half?
The 5 and the 5, 5 and a half was the 79 expected number. 74 was 4.4. We're selling debt at a pretty prodigious rate right now. Moody says it's a very aggressive program.
Thank you.
One of the intriguing things, though, about the capital move plan, the period in which the bonds are started being paid off is in a time period when we don't know much about the future. In 1987, Prudhoe Bay declines. Prudhoe Bay is the largest mill in North America, and we'll take it something very large to replace Prudhoe Bay. I've structured the state's debt service to fit what I call the Prudhoe curve, to fit the revenues as it comes out of Prudhoe Bay, and because I'm hopeful, but I don't want to hurt our financial condition in case there are not substantial revenues coming out of new discoveries. So, and it's a whole capital move plan is putting that debt service out into a period of years when Prudhoe Bay is rapidly declining. And it will fill in a hole in the state's debt structure. There is not much debt in that current area. Most of our debt will be paid by the mid-80s. But Prudhoe Bay, when it starts to decline in 1986 or 87, will decline probably in the 12 to 15% a year. And by 1994-95, its production will be quite a bit less than it is today. So, and that's the period in time which we're planning to pay off these bonds. So, yes, we have a thing called inflation going for us that we will be investing the money today and paying it back with depreciated dollars, but we'll also have substantially less oil flowing, and still have, I assume, a fairly large bureaucracy to feed, too.
I'd like to bring something up, since that kind of touched the nerve of all of that. Isn't that a good argument for going to direct appropriations, capital projects, and isn't, I mean, that whole argument about paying back borrowed dollars with depreciated bucks further on down the line was the reason that, it's my recollection, maybe you could say if I'm wrong, is my recollection that your department came in and said that's the reason we shouldn't go to direct appropriation.
Well, I believe, Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with you if you want to be totally financially conservative. I think you should use your debt as much as you can as long as it's stays in reasonable financial sort, namely about 5.5% of what your budget is. Because if you're doing that, it's actually costing you less money because of the rate of inflation than paying it out of cash. But yes, if you're going to do a substantial program, yes, you should be taking it out of cash. If you're going to push your debt service to astronomical levels, I would recommend that the legislature take quite a bit of this out of cash so we don't get it out in the debt service, so we have the flexibility in the future in case things don't work out.
Well, you think we ought to start this year doing that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know where you're going to get the money. We have currently in the budget, we have a $600 million surplus, $300 million of which is tied up in veterans loans and other loans, and those loan programs are growing at the tune of $150 million a year. So you have another two years approximately of loan programs before you have to turn them off. You could go sell dip into that, but you're the $600 million, but you can't pay too many bills with loan programs either.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Freeman.
I'm having a hard time staying tuned in today, Mr. Gallagher. Just a few minutes ago, you mentioned something about, as I understood what you said, most of the debt will be paid by the mid-80s.
That's right.
Do that again for me.
Our debt structure is such that most of the debt that we have outstanding, I think we have $600 million outstanding or $560. It will be paid back, the principal will be mostly paid back by 1986.
But Commissioner, if you're going to be adding to that $250-300 million year-end bonds, are you saying that the existing, what we owe right now, will most of it be paid now?
Yes, sir. What we have existing today, most of it will be paid. We have something like a 9-year average debt life. Over half our debt will be paid in 9 years.
But if you're going to be adding $250 million worth of new debts of your heart.
Well, one of the things Mr. Freeman and I am doing, like in the last bond issue, its total maturity was 11 years. The last maturity was 1989. That was all trying to keep the debts short because of worrying about future discoveries and trying to keep it under the Prudhoe curve.
Commissioner, when you sell, we authorize the people vote for a bond issue of $100 million. Do you have the authority to determine the life of those bonds? In other words,
yes, sir.
Whether 20 years or 10 years?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to get the picture. But again, I would, at the rate we're going, historically, I would think that it would be proper to say that we'll have our debt paid in 1980.
Well,
because there's going to come a time you're going to be selling 1-year bonds if we.
Well, maybe by the 1980s we'll know whether the gas line is online. We'll know whether there's how big the Point Thompson discovery is and things like that, so you can lengthen it out. But as to the knowledge we know right now, I wouldn't recommend putting out a long debt structure.
Thank you.
I want to. What you said to us, that if we did not, we are $556 million in debt now, that if we did not buy another bond, if we did not sell another bond, I should say, go into any more bond indebtedness, by 1985 we'd be completely out of debt.
No, we'd have over half that debt gone. I said we had an average life. Of 19 of 9 years, so the average is of course 50% to be gone. It's mostly by, I think, 2/3 of it under the 10-year life. Under by 1980 or 88, we have only 35% of our debt left. Or something.
I'd like to have it that way. Not sell any more bonds at all.
Okay. Anyway, let's get this back now to where it relates to capital and bonds.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, what I would recommend, if the capital move, if the current bond issues that are before the legislature and the capital move also passes, is that in 2 years hence, we substantially cut back the debt programs and go into cash programs and see how some of the developments on the North Slope take place, let's say like Point Thompson, some of those other things. Until those things are a lot better known, I would then argue for substantially cut back on the debt programs.
Where's the money going to come from?
Mr. Chairman, you have a good imagination too, so.
Mr. Chairman?
Well, that was just a question you asked me a minute ago. Justice Swanson.
Our Ways and Means Committee told us we were going to be looking at a $300 million surplus next year. Now, maybe they're wrong. I don't know.
Mr. Swanson, in 1980, the reserves tax credit falls off, and that puts in an additional $150 million a year. 1984, the Native Land Claim Settlement Act is completely paid. And so there is $250 million a year in those years that will be freed up. But also in 1987, Prudhoe Bay starts declining. And so that you have a little gap in the years there. The first year it declines by 225,000, or somewhere around 200,000 barrels a day. The year after that, it's 175, 150, it just goes right down. So there is a little gap of years there. We have quite a bit of money coming in, but it's only a short gap. And then maybe we can implement our chairman's philosophy of paying cash in those years. I'd recommend it.
I think we should pass a lot of length in that gap.
Either that or lengthen this chair of the finance director.
Okay. Let's go ahead with this.
Well, that's substantially what I had to say about the Dean Witter report and the White Well report. I am much more lean toward the recommendations that are found in the Dean Witter report than the White Well report. I think the White Well report is too optimistic.
Mr. Swanson.
Yes, you indicated that one of the reports said we go to we could go to 16% of our general fund budget. I wrote $160 million and I asked our accountant here to tell me if that was correct. That would mean $160 million debt.
Yes.
Service.
Currently.
Every year.
Currently. Yes.
Currently
we have 68 or so.
We have 50 some odd million dollars now debt service.
Or 60, somewhere
yeah,
65.
50 to 60. And that would be added, to the, if we went to the 16%, that would be added to the current debt, which would run us to $210 million debt service per year then, wouldn't it? Well, if we have 50 or 60, we have got 50 million now, and if we went to the full 16%, it's 160 million, that'd be 210 million.
I'm not sure.
Well, these are your figures.
I think I missed something along the line.
You told us a while ago.
Okay.
You told us a while ago that according to the report, report allowed us to go to 16%.
Well, that was the White Wells report said you could go up to that.
Well, I just based it on that. We have a $1 billion budget right now.
Yes.
16% of that is 160 million, unless I unless my figures are wrong.
That's
so you can only have 110
million. So we already have 50 million plus
indebtedness
right now. Our debt service today is a little about 55 million. Something.
Kind of a rule of thumbs is debt service equals about 10% of the bonds outstanding, 10-12%. If you wanted to increase it by $100 million, you'd have to sell approximately $1 billion worth of debt.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me see if we can wrap it up. As I understand it, really the gist of what you're saying is, we can authorize whatever it takes to build a new capital and the 275 or whatever the generally approved level of bonding it is this time, but next time we're gonna have to tighten our belt as far as debt.
That's right. That would be my recommendation.
Okay. Are there further questions of Commissioner Gallagher? Mr. Freeman.
Maybe not a question on Mr. Goldman, maybe a question to you. The commissioner says we can sell, if we go by the history, say 5%, that we can sell about $275 million a year bond. Is that what you think? Or whatever the figure would be.
Right. I recommend to the governor we could sell 275 this year over the next 2 years.
Okay. But the same thing would apply within reasonable limits. Same thing would apply next year and the following year?
Yes.
In other words, there's a limit how much bonds we can sell.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, is what he's saying that if we sell so many million dollars worth of bonds, then that's, we can't have bonds for something else. Is that what that means?
That's generally what it means. But you make the decisions as you go. If these things pass, my future recommendation would be to cut back substantially on other programs.
Okay. Are there further questions at this time? No, thank you. Mr. Swick, once again,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ted Swick from White Welding Company, and this is my associate, Sam Fire. I think I should point out, if some of you aren't aware of it, that the existence of White Weld as an entity that some of you may be familiar with no longer exists, because a week ago last Friday it was purchased for cash by Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. Our original report was made on White Weld letterhead. The individuals who wrote it are before you, and we are now employees, basically, of Merrill Lynch, but it doesn't change our opinions, nor, hopefully, the record of past years.
Who is Merrill Lynch owned by?
That's the guy with all the molds.
Exxon.
I wonder if I could ask.
I've made a lot of jokes about this. I can let that go by.
I wonder if I could ask him to deliver a message to my broker.
Well, they have so many of them, I'm not sure I'd be able to find them.
Okay. Mr. Swick.
Having testified on this subject once before, and I'm delighted that Commissioner Gallagher really went first, because I think it's focused for you all on the essence of our report, particularly the early part that he addressed himself to, and took what I guess we can call exceptions to some of our conclusions. I think, though, having listened to the Commissioner, I would like to change a little bit what I was going to say, just to this degree, that Commissioner Gallagher used the word recommendations in terms of issuing bonds and what he would recommend. And believe me, the remarks he made here today are such that I could not take issue with him at all. As far as a responsible management of the debt of the state, I think he said exactly the things that I would want to have the person responsible for those duties to say. The point here really is that we have not recommended that the state of Alaska issue bonds willy-nilly to get their ratio of debt service to general fund revenues to 16%. Our role was to critique, if you will, a report written by a competing firm whose name I can't recall. And we, in our report, if you have all seen it, we immediately accepted the assumptions that went into the Dean Witter report, which were spelled out quite specifically, and they were based on some other research that was available and had been performed here in Alaska. And he set up those assumptions, which we embraced and had no argument with, and didn't have no reason or attempt to change any of them. Now, I guess our remarks, to the degree that the somewhat arbitrary and in the Dean Witter report admittedly subjective results, were that they think that putting an 8% on that ratio which we're discussing was a very conservative and proper way to look at it. I think the measurement itself as something to look at is appropriate and is a good one. Our judgment, again, has got to be subjective. It's based on our feelings about the bond markets and the state of Alaska as we see it. Also, the language of the report, at least it was supposed to say, that we could see that it could go as high as 16%. Again, I emphasize we are not recommending anything, nor are we recommending that 16 is any more appropriate than 8 or 5 or whatever. Well, I don't want to hammer too hard on that, but I think that could be cleared up. Now, again, the judgments that we made about the ability of Alaska to issue what is a lot of debt, no question about it. It's our judgment, based on our experience, that Alaska can afford to do this if they so choose. Believe me, again, that's not a recommendation. I just think that, as we view Alaska, that the necessity to go into heavy debt is there, that you could go beyond the restraints put on it in the subjective conclusion of Dean Witter. Now, the other part of our report, and please interrupt me if you want to question any part of this. The other part of our report at that time followed along to the degree that once a major program is launched, how do you get that debt raised in the marketplace, and at all times trying to maintain the credit standing of the state, not destroy it. And of course, part of that is being able to raise debt at reasonable rates when you need the money. That's what we mean by access to the market. It's absolutely true that, you know, almost anybody can borrow money as long as they're willing to pay for it. We saw it back in the high inflationary and tight money periods, where some of the most prestigious companies in the lower 48 were either completely blocked out of the debt market, or they were paying 16-18% for money, those who chose to go to the market. And again, our conclusion in looking at Alaska and what it's trying to do and what it is faced with and it may have to do, can issue a heck of a lot of debt, keep access to the market, which means, of course, raising money when you need it at reasonable rates. Now, once you've gone beyond that and you go into the debt market, then we were trying to make a gratuitous, if you will, set of remarks about when you have a major program, how you can get it out there in the marketplace and get the money and not pay a market price penalty to borrow. Whether it's appropriate for me to repeat some of that now, I don't know, but I'd be delighted to. In this written report.
Mr. Switch, one thing that you brought up that I'd certainly like for you to comment on is in your report, is the proposition that the state must demonstrate a commitment to finish the capital move project in order to provide a proper market atmosphere for the sale of those bonds. And I wonder if you'd like to elaborate on that a bit, because there has been some suggestion, I think, here in the legislature that perhaps the way to go is to bond for a third of it this year and a fourth of it the next year and a third more maybe 3-4 years down the line. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
All right, sure. Well, I'd be delighted. First of all, though, if the program is in place and is going ahead, you would in fact be selling the bonds over a period of years anyway, because it would, in very rare circumstances, that you'd want to really dump that whole amount out there. But
I think
setting that aside,
referring to the authorization,
yeah, The marketplace is very willing to go into lending money to a very large project, and I'm talking about billions of dollars when I say large project. But they have some things that they look at that I tried to point out go beyond the ratios that are used by rating agencies to evaluate debt on a normal basis. And the first thing that the marketplace or the money lenders want to look at is that, boy, this thing is mammoth. Do they really want to do this? Do they know what they're getting in for? Are they going to be able to pay for it? And so on. So, in what I would call a marketing program, to borrow the money to accomplish the program, you take all of your available information that you have from planners, engineers, and so on, and you put it right out front. This thing is going to cost us, and I guess the capital move in this report talks some $3.5 billion. Yes, the report has that, I think it's 900 and some odd million will be raised by general obligation debt, which will have to be voted on. But for the public to make an informed vote on a $900 million bond issue, I think to get the atmosphere that I'm trying to get across to you is that they've got to know, and they've got to know when they vote for $900 million, that it's part of $3.5 billion. And that, so when they have a yes vote, the lenders of money are going to know that, well, by golly, the people want to do this. They understand what it's going to cost them, and they've made the commitment. Now, that's the beginning of the thing, and I think that's what the chairman was referring to. And this has been so important, and I could rattle off some examples. Down in Georgia, they got a $2 billion program for generation and distribution of electricity, which is going to serve a population approximately, by coincidence, the size of Alaska. And they went into this thing, and the investors saw what the costs were going to be, they understood it, they saw the economics, and they're buying the bonds in great abandon at the exact rates that they deserve in the marketplace. They're not paying any penalty. Other factors that get into this equation are such things as not only the willingness to pay being demonstrated by the people who are voting for the bond issues, knowing what the facts really are and stating right out front what it's going to cost. So nobody thinks he's been fooled. And this demonstrates the willingness to pay. Then the people who are going to run the show, and the leadership of the legislature, if you will, the administration, the investors want to see all you people and look you in the eye get the distinct feeling that the state of Alaska is determined to do this. They've determined that they have the assets to do it, and they're going to make it work. Now, these kind of things you can't put into a ratio between debt service and general fund revenues. You can't put it in per capita income ratios, which are used in the analysis of bonds all the time. And there's nothing the matter with these ratios. Rating agencies look at bonds and they set up mediums, and they take all of the states and they mush them all together and they say, okay, these are the good ones and these are the bad ones, and they weigh these figures. But there are, time and again, there are instances where you go beyond that and you look in the kind of things that I'm talking about. The willingness to pay as well as the ability to pay. The support of the business community, the legislature, the administration. This is a marketing job. You go out and you sell your project, and there's no secrets. Right out there, and everybody can take his own shot at it, analyze it, and decide whether he wants to lend you money.
Mr. Street?
Yes, sir.
Just to be sure that I understand what. In other words, when the people who buy the bonds, when they make a decision to buy the bonds that fund the project, they want to know that the project's going to be finished?
Yes, sir.
Completed?
Right.
Well, Can you, there's been some talks and suggestions of maybe selling bonds for half a capital move or a quarter of capital move, whatever it may be. That wouldn't agree with what you just told us, would it? That approach?
Well, I don't think that what I say changes that, because if the program is to put half the capital here and leave half there, then that's the program. And it's in place, and that's what's being launched, voted on, agreed on, and everybody's backing it. I think there's a difference in what your question implies. just because it's half and not all, if only half is the program, then that's what I'm talking about.
Let me restate it then. If it was supposed to be a full program, but we were only going to do half of it now, and maybe if the voters approved, we'd do the other half later, would that make a difference?
No, I don't think so, because that's the way you'd put it out there. We're going to do this and this and this, and it's going to cost that much, even if it's only half of what this thing is. Are we together?
Let me reword it.
All right, let's try again.
Let's assume that everybody agreed that the cost of the capital move, as far as the bonding, was $966 million, but that we only authorized on the first issue $300 million. That's all we put before the voters. That would not be putting the full
that
cost.
Would be, I'd say that would be a very bad mistake, and it would cost you in the cost of borrowing.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan.
No, Mr. Duncan, the question that I asked yesterday about the three-phase building, that is the answer right there. No, I have another question.
Mr. Swanson?
I'm talking about the money lender now, as you look at it.
Yes, sir.
Look at our project. You look at it. When you're analyzing to loan RB a $2.5 billion project, you mentioned a hydroelectric power project somewhere, and you had no problem with that. When you look at a project like this one that has no return other than the ability of the taxpayer and the state to pay, notwithstanding our oil field, and I fully understand that when you look at our capital city, you look at how much oil is in Prudhoe Bay and how much of that backs our capital move, because that's where the money is. Would a bond to build a capital city command a higher rate of interest than a bond to build a hydroelectric power project that would be built under a revenue measure and would be almost guaranteed in return if you got invested in it? Which would command the higher rate of interest? Which is?
The hydro project has to stand on its own earnings.
Right.
That would be have a higher cost of borrowing than bonds issued as a credit of the state to build a state capital.
Further question, Mr. Swanson?
Yeah.
I would, if there's another question for the committee at this point, or did you wish to continue on?
No, sir.
I have one question I would like to ask you, and that's about revenue bonds. Could we move the capital with revenue bonds? We chose to do so, would that be more expensive? Would that require voter approval, or did we bypass voter approval? What about revenue bonds?
Well, the question of voter approval is a legal question, but without having thought about it recently, I guess revenue bonds may be sold in Alaska without public vote. I think that's correct. A revenue bond, as you I'm sure are aware, is really, to put it another way, a user pay type cash flow arrangement. And they are subject to a different method of analysis than a general state credit bond. As a class of security, they are generally thought of as less creditworthy than a general government bond. So that in far terms of cost of borrowing, basically or generally speaking, it would cost more on the revenue bond for debt. No question. Now there are exceptions to everything, and there are some revenue bonds that sell very, very well. But that is purely an economic cash flow analysis. Granted on a new project based on assumptions of experts such as engineers and so on and economists who have a good reputation and a good history of predicting the income of a revenue producing project. And bondholders will rely on those estimates and will buy bonds, and so the rating agencies will buy bonds and rate bonds based on the potential of a revenue producing user pay type activity. Now, I think what I'm saying, if you're not familiar with it, when you're starting from zero, which is capital move type development. Why, until you create something, there is no revenue flow. There's nobody there to put a nickel in the turnstile. So that the possibility of revenue bonds in the early stages of the capital development, I would say there would be no market.
Then the
now when utilities for the service of the residents was in and they were people to pay sewer bills and water bills and electric light bills, why, that's an entirely different story.
But a revenue bond of the magnitude that it would take to build a state capital without the full faith and credit of the state behind it, the interest rates would probably be...
I don't think you could borrow the money.
Couldn't even borrow it.
There are, well, I was going to say, for instance, the state office building rather than the capital themselves, but there are plenty of cases down in the lower 48 where they're called revenue bonds, and a state building commission will build a building, say, for the legislature and, or for the Department of Highways or what have you, and they pay rent to the agency, and that gets its money from appropriation, where you end up right back in the general fund appropriation process anyway. But they call those revenue bonds. But in this case, it would go right back to the general fund.
Further questions from the committee? Mr. Duncan.
Hey, well, I'd like to go back again. I think we determined after Mr. Freeman's questions, my question, that if you put less than the total bondable cost up, that would be bad as far as the
it's so big and you just got to get it out and make people believe, yes.
Okay, then the other question, which I think you first interpreted Mr. Freeman's question to be, was what if we had half a move? That was the plan for half a move, move half the capital. And that's what we were bonding for. You indicated that the bond market would have no problem with that, but wouldn't you expect there might be some concern in the minds of people looking at that half a move really means another half later on, and then perhaps it might to bring about some sort of penalty provision or higher interest rate on the first bonds?
I think that's a danger, yes, but in the remarks I was making, I would say that in my so-called marketing program of your program, to the lenders, you'd have to prove to them that wasn't a problem.
That'd be very difficult to prove, though, don't you believe? How would the state prove that to you, that we were intent on only having half a move instead of later moving half now and in 5 years moving the other half?
If the expectation or the demonstration of support for it, and that it, in the judgment of those involved, both the political community in terms of legislature and administration and the business community and the people who have to live with their state government and how it's going to function, if they're convinced and can convince others, I see no problem. It has to be addressed. Now, you can't push it under the rug.
I don't mean to interpret
how hard it would be to sell. I don't know.
I don't mean to interpret your answer. I think what you're saying is it probably would be a difficult thing to sell, and it's quite possible that there would be.
You have to address some very positive remarks about it, yes. In this marketing program. And by marketing program, it isn't clear to you, I mean a delegation from here representing all parts of your community, maybe a 10 or 15 man team, would go visit the capital financial centers of the lower 48 and sell this thing to the institutional
body. It appeared to me on some issues that would be an easier program to sell than on an issue with the emotions surrounding it, such as the capital move, wouldn't you say? That
yes, sir.
Very volatile,
yes, sir.
Political issue.
It's got to be everybody's there, everybody's shoulders to the wheel. May never get there.
Ms. Buckle.
Yeah, I think Stern and Gallagher earlier mentioned that our credit rating would go down if we went through the process, the 60% that you have suggested. And that would put us on the basis of some of the states that are not exactly enjoying good credit rating. But how far below what is considered a good credit rating can we go with the bonding process that we must go through in the capital?
You don't want to get it reduced at all, and there, Commissioner Gallagher is certainly right that under undisciplined and not properly managed debt policies, you're going to lose your credit rating. But if it ever deteriorated lower than A, which is down from where the state is now, why then your cost of borrowing would escalate at a much higher degree. Having dropped, say, below an A rating, the next level, you may be aware, is BAA. Once you get to BAA, your costs of borrowing on a SOAR are just be a terrible burden. Whether or not the program involved in the capital move would cause your rating to be lowered, I don't happen to think it would. I'm also not in the rating agency business. We deal with them all the time. We think we know what they're thinking about. And that's part of our job. But there's no question on a massive program that just goes on and gets out of hand that that rating can be lost. And it's very expensive. You know, I can't tell you that if you do 10 bonds or 100 bonds, which one's going to tip you to go down and change your rating. I can't answer that. So I'm not sure the rating agencies could themselves.
Well, would it make a difference is looking at that pie chart on the wall there where we have at least 65% of the private sector participating in this project. Would it make a difference in the bond market that so many people are involved in this project? Therefore, our credit rating would not be minimized in any manner.
Gosh, I'm not sure I... Is that what's going to happen?
No.
Sorry, I'm going to come back to you.
This is a very perfect place. That's what we're here about.
Actually, private participate, you know, government is people, and private and government in that sense is everybody working together. Now, I know I'm not getting to your question, but you're asking me if the private participation, because the private participation may be so high, that's a hurdle?
No, but that would enhance our chances to sell our bonds.
Well, what it means to me is that you would have to sell less bonds, for one thing, because the private market doesn't have access to this marketplace that I'm concerned. If I missed the question, I'm sorry.
No, what I was saying is that, you know, it seems to me that when you sell your, when you're around doing this project,
yeah.
And the kinds of statements that have been made in other committees, and I've been trying to catch up on all of them. We are holding hearings on this, and this is really the first time in the Finance Committee where we are really addressing the issue. What I was most interested in is that the fact that there is a great deal of participation on the private sector, private industry, and it would probably enhance our picture, overall picture in this project. And in trying to sell bonds and buying and selling that perhaps it would encourage those people to, wherever they are who are buying these bonds, that the state is not the kind of predicament that other states might get into, because we do have the interest and the cooperation of the private sector. This is what I was trying to say.
Yes, well, there's no question it's important, but I think that once a program is established and the state is in a position where it can launch on a marketing program, you know, government can be a leader, and it is many times. And once the thing happens and the debates stop and the action starts, I think you'll find the private sector jumps on, and they want to be a part of it, and it's darn important, yes.
Further questions from the committee? Any further statements, Mr. Speaker? If there are no further questions from the committee, we want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next on the list was the Capital Planning Commission. You're on.
Thank you.
Chairman, that there are a few statements which we didn't make yesterday, which I'll make as we go along today. We've addressed so many different committees about so many different bills relating to capital planning, and sometimes we've forgotten what we said to whom. First of all, I'd like to point out that through the course of our planning process, we have followed a process whereby consultants were asked to get reports to us quickly, preliminary reports to us quickly, so that they could be bounced off the commission staff, and other consultants who work in approximately the same areas. This perhaps explains why there have been conflicting numbers and conflicting statements regarding capital, what the Capital Planning Commission is doing and what it is and has indeed done. We had one report, that's a report at 10%, and it was clearly stated for discussion purposes only, draft copy and so on. But anyhow, this got into the press because it was a public document. We came back with many changes in that financial report, and the report that you have, which is bound like this, is the report which we can best stand behind. There are still numbers because of the timing that we had to embrace that are indeed haywire even in this. We find mistakes in it from day to day. I don't think there are gross mistakes. There is one gross mistake in the private area, but I don't think that has much to do with what we're discussing here. Yesterday, there were several questions asked, and Mr. Hogan asked.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in knowing that gross mistake in the private area.
Mr. Duncan.
Excuse me.
I'd be interested in knowing what the gross mistake is in the private area.
We counted land costs one place twice. I'll have to show you privately what the error is. But it's a matter of, as I recall, about $100 million, and that's to me is pretty gross.
Why does he have to know that privately?
I have to show him where it is privately because I can't find it here.
All right,
come on now, Red.
I want there's a deal. I want a piece of the action.
Well, I don't think it will be kept a secret, as have some other things. The Mr. Hogan asked yesterday about any studies that we may have made in relation to what impact the capital move might have on bonding capacity and so on. And it perhaps would have been better if we had had our consultant here and he could have gone first, because the other men have already discussed the Dean Witter report. And I'm not a bond man, but I'll attempt to tell you a little bit about the Dean Witter report so these other discussions will perhaps make a little bit more sense. We asked Dean Witter to try to make some sort of a study of how our proposed bonds, or public proposed bonds for the new capital, would impact on the state's bonding capacity. And they ran out a couple of scenarios. One scenario was based on not having the state's debt service going appreciably beyond 8% of general fund revenues. Now bear in mind that the general fund revenues also include what would be taken out for the permanent fund. Based on that, they were able to establish a scenario whereby if the state were to sell $100 million in bonds per year for things not associated with the capital, and also sold bonds as prescribed for in our financial plan. And these begin at about $8.8 million in 1980 and build up to considerable millions in the late 1980s and then drop off. That the debt service would rise to, I believe it's 8.27% of what was anticipated to be the general fund revenues over that time span. So this is one scenario. They weren't necessarily recommending that the state go to 8% debts, 8% of general fund revenues for debt service. They simply said, if you do this, this is what happens. They also ran another scenario at 5.5% of general fund revenues. And for this, it was possible to sell $40 million in bonds per year for other things and tack on our programmed bond schedule and not get appreciably above 5.5%. It's a little above 5.5%, but it's very close to 5.5%. These are the two scenarios they ran out. They also, however, went a little bit farther, and, well, let me digress for a moment. You have to realize that the $100 million per year that they were talking about, or the $40 million per year that they were talking about, were in dollars. They were not in escalated dollars or some other type of dollars. They were dollars of the day. Actually, they were escalated dollars. This means that the $100 million that would be sold for in 1994 would buy about, at an 8% escalation rate, would buy about what $29 million would buy today. So the value of those $100 million per year is decreasing. The buying power is decreasing each year, and you should realize this. The $40 million bonds the same way. The value of the $40 million is decreasing, but it's not the same. They ran out another scenario to look at bonding in the state of Alaska as opposed to just bonding by the state in terms of general obligation bonds. And they took the following scenario. They plugged in the capital move bonds as projected by our commission. They plugged in $100 million per year for other state projects. And then they took what other state and municipal agencies are selling today, and I don't recall what the number was, $250 million, $300 million a year. Anyhow, they escalated what the other agencies were selling at 8% per annum. And by 1994, the total of bonds that were being sold by the state for capital, the state for other things, and then these other public agencies came almost to $1 billion. And the bond was 900 and a heavy fraction, $1 million per year. And our bond counsel was very concerned about that. He said he didn't really think that if this went that way, the state could swing it. And you should know what he told another committee. Bill, do you have anything to add to that? This Bill Corbis, I'm saying. Mr. Hogan, do you have any questions about the report? This is in our document 9B, the Dean Witter report. Yeah, but if you want to refer to it, or you want to, if you'd like to ask any other questions about it, I'd be happy to meet you and discuss it with you. Yesterday, Mr. Duncan asked two questions. One was in relation to some numbers which were tabulated. There were Xerox copies of the Capital Planning Commission's documents that are in here. And I've discussed this with him, but I think it probably is worthwhile to look at it so that everyone see where the $200 million went. On page 40, Capital Plan, American City Corporation's Capital Planning Document, January 9th, 1978, is the one I'm referring to. It's white paper immediately preceding brown paper here. I don't know. I was in this report, which you received yesterday. I don't know how yours is bound. Capital site cost tab. Let me refer to page number at the bottom of this, which is page 48. And if you look at the columns, it says at the top on the right-hand side amount in 1978 and then escalated at 10% per year.
This is the page I'm looking at. Mr. Duncan had a question yesterday regarding summaries at the bottom of the page. Here you'll note that we have written state $547.8 million in the 1978 column. And beneath that two lines, there was a borough item of $125.4 million, and we agreed that that was for schools, and it's tabulated as such either on this page or previous page. Now, if you go back to, and I want to first of all say that this was a, for discussion purposes only, and we discussed this document a great deal, and we made many changes in it. Probably the most significant one was the 8%, we went to 8% inflation rate instead of 10%, there were many other changes we made. Now, if you go back toward the front of your documents, let's see, one, two, three pages, there's a page that looks like this. It says 58 on the bottom of it. This is a summary sheet, a Xerox summary sheet of one of our planning documents, which is the latest document that we have. If you go to the bottom of the page there, on the left-hand side under 1978, it says 506.5 opposite state, and opposite borough, it says nothing. And Mr. Duncan said yesterday that I indicated that we probably had moved the schools into the state account, and he said, well, that's all fine, but how come the state account didn't go up? And that was a pretty good question. We did put that into the state account. We also made about $32 or $33 million in other changes, additions to the state account. But in the 8% document, the final document, we recognized land sales. We had not recognized those, and that was one of the errors that was in the earlier document. We had not recognized land sales, and in 1978 dollars, those land sales boiled down to $202.2 million, and this is in brackets just above the total there. So in essence, we moved schools over to the state account. We moved something like $30 million and other things over to the state account. And that brought that up to $708 million or thereabouts. And then from that, we subtracted land sales of $202.2 million in $78. And that brought us down to 506.5. And again, I think it should be pointed out, and we perhaps didn't emphasize this enough yesterday, there have been those who have said, why don't you sell land, or why don't you trade the land for a whole new capital? We're selling land. We're selling lots of land here, and at prices that are good prices. So the land sales are indeed included here.
In your projections, when do the land sales, when's the first revenue come in off the land sales?
Well, the first revenues come in, they have to come in 1982 or 83 because there are houses being sold and land being developed at that time. It isn't very significant at that time.
You have scheduled out the big part of the revenue comes towards the latter years.
That's right. For example, in 1987, the city, this is a magic number in these halls now, I guess, and in 1987, the population of the city is about 11,100. Whereas in 1994, it's 37,500, so more than two-thirds of the land is sold. I don't remember the exact land sale rate, but anyhow, more than two-thirds of the residences are sold after 1987. A lot of money does come back.
Because my thought is that seems pretty speculative, that you're going to receive that revenue off of land sales. Therefore, you're reducing, based on that speculation, you're reducing the bondable cost by about $200 million. I'm wondering what that might do in the bond market.
That's a question you can't address to me.
I'm wondering if I could address it to Mr. Weld, Mr. Chairman.
If
he could. With respect, excuse me. I forgot when they changed colors, they changed your name.
Well, we're talking about the whole plan now, I believe, and actually, as I recall, the proceeds of land sales have already been calculated in the figure that arrived in the 966 escalated total bond requirements, so I don't know the direct bearing on the amount of bonds that are going to be sold on the plan.
What it does is I see it because they took that revenue from the land sales and decreased the state cost by $202 million.
Not the costs of the, not the cost of the things that we had proposed to be bonded, though. This might affect general fund. Could affect general fund, but it wouldn't, as I see it, affect bond.
Well, to answer the question in a general sense, if you can accomplish the same purposes and sell, you know, issue $200 million less debt, it's certainly not going to hurt you.
What was your general fund contribution under the 10% plan? You're saying that you didn't reduce the bondable cost, but you reduced the general fund cost by $200 million with the land sale?
The land sales affect not the cost that we intended to bond, but they affect the general fund. Now bear in mind that land...
I don't see it that way.
Well,
but
general obligation bonds would be sold to provide the $966 million of... See, this $202 million that they're saying comes back in land sales doesn't affect the general obligation bonds because the general obligation bonds are sold up front, or very close to up front.
We're looking at page 58, too.
In which,
Where we were, looking at page 58. I'm probably not following this, so it's freaking me out. But as I see that, you've got $506 million there in state, under state, and $78. Is that correct? 506.5, and escalated at 8% a year, that's a $1,012,000, which is the bondable cost, correct? Part of the bondable cost.
Part of the bondable cost is there, yeah.
The $1,012,000 is bondable, is that correct?
I don't think I could say what's bondable. I'd say what is bonded. The Attorney General is making that rule.
Or under the Attorney General's opinion, then that $1,012,000 is bondable cost. The billion. I'm looking at page 58 at the state.
Okay.
The 19 at the escalated dollars is a billion.
He said more than that. He said $1,012,000,000.
Well, I think he said
$1.4 billion.
Okay, but that, in my mind, is all bondable there. And just a very small percentage of it, even under your plan, is not bondable cost. Because under your plan, $966 million is bondable. Now, what I'm saying is that state figure you told me has been reduced by $202 million because of land sales. So it would appear that land sales is reducing, the majority of that land sales is also reducing bondable cost. You're telling me no.
I don't agree with you on that. I don't think it would reduce that. Now, I have to think about this a little more, but I don't think it would reduce the bondable cost. I think it would affect general fund revenues later on because these land sales come into our financial plan, into the Capital Development Corporation, and it is,
but at a late date.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They affect the general fund. I don't believe they affect the bondable or the bond.
Well, I think that's right.
Sure. I think the Planning Commission went at it from the point of view of what is normally bondable in our finance plan. So that's the $966 million is something that would normally be bondable by the state. However, there were a number of things, such as streets, the distribution utilities for water and sewer. These are not the main trunk line, but things of that nature that normally when a person buys a piece of property, a lot that's been developed, that he pays for that when he buys the lot. The development corporation is the one that developed these facilities. And when they borrowed money from the legislature via the general fund, and develop these facilities. Then these lots were in turn sold to people, and the monies were paid back to the state. Now, the Attorney General has said that it is possible that the state could bond these facilities. And so that's where the difference is.
Yeah, I guess I'm making it too simple, but I still don't understand it. Or maybe it's too complex. Let's take a look at the 8% a year column, if you could, Bill. At the 8%, escalated 8% a year column, you've got state cost of a billion, a little bit more. Federal cost so much, new municipality cost so much, and private cost so much. Now, you have said yourself, under your plan, that $966 million of that is bondable.
We propose to bond it. More than that is bondable.
All right, you propose a bond, $966 million. Where does that $966 million fall in that column?
Most of the 966 is within the billion 12.
Okay, that's what I thought. Now, under the 10% plan and the escalated dollars, that is $1.4 billion. Or actually, it's $1.4 billion, and you said you've done some switching there. You took out the move the schools and to the state. You moved because of land sales. You decreased it by 200 and some million. Maybe I'm not following it, but it would appear to me that your decrease then is coming in cost that you could bond for.
Right. We could bond for it, but we chose not to. And rather than bonding for it, we took those monies and passed them on to the people who were going to buy the property.
Okay, rather than bond for it, you're basing it on revenues from land sales, which are highly speculative at this point.
To you, perhaps.
Yeah. Let me comment just a little bit further. In the development plan, this thing here with all the fallout sheets, you can follow the bonding year by year.
What we propose
to have bonded, and if you follow the income. The income was indicated under the state general fund category.